Hello and welcome to the Do One Better podcast in philanthropy, sustainability, and social entrepreneurship. I'm your host, Alberto Ligi from London. Please click that subscribe button and follow us if you're not already doing so, and do leave us a rating and a review. It helps others to find this show as well. Today, it's an absolute pleasure to welcome back onto the show Rose Caldwell, Chief Executive Officer of Plan International UK. Many of you have heard of Plan International. They're a global organization focusing on children's rights and girls' education. And we're going to be hearing about the work they do, where they operate, and especially we're going to be focusing on the whole notion of localization and ensuring that local voices are heard and are part of that discourse, that conversation and decision-making when it comes to what the programs look like and what the funding looks like and so forth. So, Rose, without further ado, a big heartfelt welcome back onto the Do One Better podcast today.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Excellent. So you're the Chief Executive Officer of Plan International here in the UK. You were with us about 3.5 years ago. So what I'd love to do today is start off by finding out a little bit about Plan International today, where things are. When we spoke, we were pretty much on the eve of COVID. Now we're sort of at the tail end of that, hopefully. What's been going on?
So Plan International is a large international NGO. So we work in about 80 countries around the world, particularly focusing on children's rights and equality for girls. So we work in community-based programs all around the world, particularly focusing with, giving girls education, making sure that they're safe from harm and violence, that they have the ability to make decisions over their own body, and that they are empowered into leadership roles. So really working. But in order to do that, we work in a gender transformative way. So it's not only working with girls, we have to work with the communities and the men and boys in those communities to create an enabling environment. So, yeah, so since we last spoke, Alberto, we were right in the middle of sort of COVID, no travel, pivoting all of our programs to COVID response. And my goodness, hasn't so much changed since then.
Absolutely. It's a different world.
It's a different world. It's a different world and different challenges.
Yeah. And so your team, out of curiosity now, are you folks all in the office? Has it become a hybrid thing? Because I imagine on that front as well, there may have been some changes.
Yeah. We could not have imagined before COVID the acceleration of change that has brought. So much of it's good. Of course, there's challenges with some of it. So Plan International UK, we work entirely hybrid. So we have an office base, but people sort of teams decide how many regular working patterns. Obviously, we link up with our programs overseas. And one of the real advantages, I think, for all of us is that I think in international organizations it has really made us much more connected. Everybody is so much more connected. We do so much more conversations with our country offices, which, you know, before COVID, we probably could have done, but we just didn't do it. And because of this new way of working, it's so easy to do. So I think there's a lot of advantages to in an international organization to sort of the connectedness. We've even been able to do visits out to programs with technology. And, you know, instead of trustees going to visit the programs overseas, we've taken them on a virtual visit of some of our program at work. Obviously, it's not quite the same, but there are advantages to it. So we are working very much in a hybrid way. And that goes for a lot, most of Plan offices around the world. It's very hybrid.
On that front of referencing the offices around the world, give us a little bit of a refresher. So you're Plan International here in the UK.
That's right.
Plan International is a global organization. How do you fit into the puzzle and what's the puzzle look like?
So Plan International is a membership organization. Has at the minute about 22 members. Those members tend to be from the global north. They tend to be the fundraising, sort of advocacy influencing organizations that support all of our work, which is delivered through our delivery partner global, Plan International Inc. So we deliver everything through one delivery part of the organization with about 22 members. One of the things that we are working on is broadening the membership of Plan International, because we recognize that it is a very global north dominated sort of organization. And so recently we brought on as two new members, Plan Brazil and Plan Indonesia. And we are working with other of our currently country offices to become national offices and members of the Plan sort of membership family. So, for example, Nigeria, Kenya, a few of the other offices, we're looking to really try and do that. And then they become members and have seats at the highest governance level within the organization, and hopefully start to change the dynamics and the diversity of those conversations.
Got it. Got it. So are your members then, some of them are almost entirely fundraising stroke advocacy, others, without generalizing, but those who are on in the Global South perhaps are more about delivery, programmatic delivery, and then you may have some like Brazil where you have big philanthropy and big needs as well?
Yeah, so historically it has always been, the membership has always been just the fundraising. You know, if you've got the, you know, the fundraising, and this is a construct that we're trying to change, okay? Because if we continue on that way, that it can only be those organizations that can raise enough funds to contribute to all of our programs overseas, we won't be able to bring on some of our offices in Kenya will be able to fundraise from themselves, but not contribute to the wider organization, for example. So we're in the process of looking at how we can change those membership rules so that we can hopefully bring on parts of the organization that are less able to contribute globally, but can raise funds for within their own country, for example. So we're trying to really stretch the model and look at the model and see how we can change the model.
Yeah. I know when we were talking earlier, words like localization, decolonization, big topics in philanthropy these days, big topics in international development. How is that impacting your work? How is that impacting the strategy and how you're perceiving things going forward?
Hugely. I mean, and in a positive way. So Plan International has, as part of its global strategy, and therefore all of our strategies, a pillar called locally led, globally connected. And I think this is also one of the things that, you know, we really learned during COVID. This local presence, the capacity and the ability to adapt and deliver locally is just phenomenal. And you know, through the way we have grown up as organizations and the colonized sort of history that we all come from, you know, we had this sense that we had to be there and we had to be, and that has changed. That I think during COVID has really, it was recognized before as a problem, but COVID accelerated that change of really, you know, challenging us to think much harder about our construct and the way we operate. So, you know, one of those things is to look at our governance and our membership and who's different. Plan is also, we're very pleased to be part of an initiative called Pledge for Change. So this is an initiative that was sort of started with a Southern civil society organization called ADESO and Degan Alley, along with INGO leaders who sort of said, look, the grand bargain, which was an agreement that was reached in 2016 after the World Humanitarian Summit, or during the World Humanitarian Summit, which said, you know, at the minute, all of the majority of humanitarian funding goes to big international organizations. Small, local, or an even national level organizations in Kenya, in Ethiopia, they can't access that money. But they're on the ground, they have the context, they know how to deliver, but they can't access that. So the grand bargain basically was a commitment by donors to give 25% of funds to direct to local civil society. Roll forward to where we are now, that has not happened. Okay. That's really not happened at all. So the INGO leaders have, recognized that, and we also recognize that we have to take some responsibility. We can't have the do you know, depend on the donors to say this is how you have to do it. So we came together to sort of thought, well, how can we disrupt the system? How can we change our large international families to be more locally led? Pledge for Change came about, and that's where we pledged to build a sort of stronger aid system, or ecosystem based on the principles of solidarity, humility, self-determination, and equality. And there's three key pledges within that, and one of them is to pledge to have equitable partnerships, to pledge for authentic storytelling, and also we pledge to try and change and influence the wider system. So Plan has signed up to that, and I sit on the steering committee where we're really trying to influence within our families to change the way we work. And one of the great things of Pledge for Change is that we have the big INGOs sort of really trying to look at how we can change ourselves. But the other side of that is that we have a group of southern-based civil society organisations to hold us to account. And so we've created a sort of an accountability framework, which is different from the normal traditional ones, where, it is Southern civil society saying to us, not good enough, not good enough. We like what you're doing, but we think you can go further. And they don't hold back. I met with them last year, and, they tell you how they see it. And sometimes that is quite hard for us as INGOs, who, if you think of our mandate and what we're here to do, and I think everybody accepts and recognizes that we are here to try to improve the lives of people affected by poverty and inequality. But sometimes, it's the negative effects that we have. It's the unintended consequences. And so, I think fundamentally, if you believe that thriving civil society is really important for any country, then part of that is to make sure that we as large INGOs don't suck up all the funds, suck up all the space, and close that space for the civil society. Because let's face it, many governments in those countries are doing that anyway. So they don't. So how do we create more space? How do we create more equity in our partnerships and redistribute that? And it's not easy. If it was easy, we would have done it. It is really hard to do because there's the system set up against that. It's not set up to behave in that way.
And in terms of those partnerships, I guess it's a two-way street in some ways, right? Because you have an individual local partner who would have firsthand knowledge and experience, lived experience of what's going on in their world and around their neighborhood. On the other hand, your vantage point is much more of scale, understanding the system, understanding how to drive forward that system so that indeed children's rights, girls' equality, and so forth are achieved. So I imagine it's a two-way street, right? They can benefit from some of your understanding of the broader system and how the different partners and the different supports that you're providing work with each other, and they give you a little bit of a better insight into what's going on in their local space.
Absolutely. I mean, I think this is the, from my perspective, it's very much about balancing up these relationships because they are unbalanced. Even if we look at our relationship between Plan UK and maybe our country office, say in Niger, it's not an equal partnership because we are generally the people that have the money. We're generally the people that are demanding the reports and saying you need to do it this way. But we can change it. We can change it through mindsets, through support in that country office to have much more strength themselves and been delivering what they can deliver. So there's the partnerships with local with our own country offices. But then there's also the partnership with civil society. And I think the biggest challenge for me, the biggest challenge we have with local civil society is quite often they're treated like service suppliers, service delivery partners. Go and deliver that service on our behalf and we will pay you. But we don't give them their fair share of overheads. We don't give them the fair share of finances. And so all they can ever do is keep delivering, but they can never grow their organizations because they don't have those overheads or extra surplus money that they can do that. And so, Plan has 3,500 partners worldwide. Okay. So we do work in partnership. not all of those 3.5, from my perspective, and we've done some work on this, sort of looking at different typologies of partnerships, and not every partnership has to be strategic and transformational, because it's very hard to see with 3,500 partners how you can do that. But certainly identifying some key strategic partners and working really hand in hand with them. I think both of us, and we do know this, we learn a lot from each other, but we need to change the language and the funding and how we do this. So we are working hard to look at how we can pilot this, how we can try to change our mindsets, how we strengthen different parts of the organization. So there's a lot of work going into it, and we're setting out a roadmap, sort of saying, well, this is what we plan to do, and this is how we're going to measure our progress from now to 2030, because it's going to take a long time.
And you mentioned it's not easy. I can't imagine it possibly being easy, especially with the scale that you guys have. When you're sitting around the boardroom or the senior management team meetings, both here in the UK, but also the broader Plant International family, what are some of those more granular developments or innovations or changes that you see to the way you're going about your business? So how are you seeing that sort of execution of that aspiration that you're flagging up here? How are you envisioning it's actually happening now or will be happening in the near future?
So, you know, the first thing I would say that I have seen is, since we sort of adopted this sort of strategic pillar and our membership of Pledge for Change, is just a real buzz throughout the whole organization, and an acknowledgement and you know, people are talking about it, they're engaging with it. So, you know, that's always the first step, isn't it? I think we also have to remember that there's been other things happening as well at the same time. For example, the Black Lives Matter movement and the anti-racism sort of challenges that has happened at the same time, the big focus on decolonization. And I think these things all coming together, and organizations acknowledging that they come from a colonial past and that there has, you know, been challenges, and sort of really making a commitment to becoming anti-racists, to decolonizing and to localizing. That conversation is now really live, whereas I would say 4 years ago it was there but quiet. Now it's out there and it's loud. And so that's one change that I think is really critical. Now that you've got that out there, you've got the environment in which to bring about change. Okay. And so across the organization, there's quite a lot of initiatives happening. So one of the very tangible things that we did in the UK, we've got experts in to review our, from a sort of anti-racism and decolonization lens, our advocacy materials, fundraising materials, the general stuff that we put into the public, and to tell us how we were doing. And it was a quite uncomfortable conversation. But, you know, it's stuff that we needed to hear. OK, and so out of that, we have really sort of become, you know, really thoughtful work went into developing anti-racism communication principles, which has changed the way we present a lot of the work that we do. Make sure that you have, if the work's delivered by partners, make sure you're putting your partners front and center, not plan. You know, if just lots of small things that add up to make quite a lot of difference. When we're doing our advocacy reports, don't forget to bring the colonized history into the context of where we are today. So we started with saying, here's the problem, but we didn't go back and say, what was the impact of colonization on this and how did it lead to some of the challenges? That was sort of silent. So really, it has made us think quite a lot about what we do, how we present things, how we present issues in the public, and it's been a really good challenge. That's another of those small sort of concrete examples that we've been doing to try and make a change. And then we're also looking at, you know, in the UK we do some youth participatory grant making, where we make grants to young change makers, but the people who decide who get the grants are actually the cohort from the year before. They design the sort of application process, the assessment process, and they are very heavily involved in deciding who gets those grants. So really sort of challenging ourselves, giving away power, giving away control, but not taking unnecessary risks.
And not easy to do, challenging, as you pointed out. One of the things that you said a second ago struck a chord in that, people are individuals, people have different views, not everybody agrees with each other, not everybody should agree with each other, but you are comfortable having these uncomfortable conversations. And I think that's admirable, because the minute that you shut down debate is the minute you're going to have a problem. But being uncomfortable in a forum where you have a framework to agree and disagree and have civilized debate, I think that's a really good way of ensuring that your way forward is going to be fruitful.
And I think that is very much, within PLAN, we have our values, but they're based on the feminist leadership principles. And I think that really, if I am totally honest, I'm not really always comfortable with the uncomfortable conversations. Sometimes I can be a bit sort of, cross and annoyed about these things. But because we have these, really strong embedded leadership principles, you then stop and think and you realize, actually, that's a really good thing. That is a really good thing that I feel cross and uncomfortable and challenged. And let me sit with it for a few days. And then you really begin to appreciate and value and see the other perspective. And I think it's a really interesting thing that I have learned, certainly through my journey with PLAN, because of the feminist leadership principles, which, some days we're better at them than others. Some days we're not very good at them at all. But it does, I think, generate change.
Is this a new mindset in terms of being comfortable with these uncomfortable conversations, irrespective of the topic of today versus tomorrow? There might be some other issue of contention that also deserves an uncomfortable debate. But is that something that you're finding that's an increasing appetite within PLAN to have these candid conversations that are tactful, but that are not always for everybody to agree on? This is having that sort of healthy debate.
It's quite interesting. I mean, I think PLAN is just a maybe a more a microcosm of society as a whole, right? Okay, so it's a reflection of society, and but what we do try to do at PLAN is to create an environment where it is safe to have these conversations. We don't always succeed, but we really that's what we try to do. I think it's also trying to create an environment where you can have the conversations, but recognizing that you can have those conversations, but what the outcome of them isn't always what you want. So if you're having a conversation with a large group of staff, everybody has different views. It's great to have the conversation, but at the end of the day, we do have to make decisions and move forward, and that will not please everybody. So it's finding that balance of having the space to have the discussion, but the recognition that because maybe it didn't go your way or somebody else's way, it's not that it wasn't heard and discussed. It was and appreciate it, but ultimately we do have to make some decisions, and I think because we work with really passionate and amazing staff, they have lots of views and opinions and different things. And so for me as the chief executive, one of the challenges that I often have is how do we make sure that we stay in our swim lane? Because it would be so easy to sort of let's go and do this. Let's go and do that. There's so much need out there. There's so many different issues. And so we focus on children's rights and equality for girls. But even if you take those issues within that, it's a huge spectrum of issues. And so I think one of the challenges is to be able to have the discussion, but be able to sort of try and make sure that we stay focused and doing what we can do with the resources that we have.
Yeah. I mean, oftentimes figuring out what to say no to strategically is more difficult than finding out things you could do, right?
Absolutely correct. And I think that is, and I think our staff would, challenge us in that as well, because we, it does at times feel that the demands are increasing, particularly if we look at the humanitarian crisis around the world. And so we're trying to do our business as usual, which is a more longer term development. And then you add crisis after crisis on top of that. And of course, these crises are so complex. There is a sense, but we do also have to look at what is feasible to do. And I think a lot of UK-based charities are feeling the impact of the cost of living crisis. And so resources, we're having to do more with less because the demands are increasing, the resources are less, and it's a very difficult place. You know, it's challenging. It's challenging. It's challenging for staff because we're frustrated. We want to do more. We see the need, but there is a limited amount of resources. And so back to your question is, it does make us really think very closely about what it is we can do, what we should not do, which we'd really like to, but sometimes we have to say we can't do that and keep that focus really central and look at where we can have the biggest impact.
On the living cost of living crisis that you referenced a second ago, how is that impacting you guys and your fundraising? And I mention this because the squeaky wheel gets the oil, right? A lot of the times, and you have to be a bit of your own cheerleader. And so if you're feeling like plugging for Plan International and saying, look, we do welcome donations, feel free to say so.
We are always very welcoming of donations. And I mean, I think my plug would be the greatest growth accelerator is girls' education. If you can educate girls, you can actually change the world. And, you know, Plan International does a huge amount of work around educating girls and making sure that they're safe and they're able to go to school. And the difference that it can make is phenomenal. And we know that there's a huge, particularly in Africa, increase in the youth population, and countries are struggling to educate those people. And so for us at Plan, it's really critical that we do that. And, you know, how's the cost of it? It's tough. I mean, in the UK market, it's very tough. We've had the UK government has obviously reduced the amount of money going to international development quite very significantly. So it's not only the 0.5 of that 0.5, now a third of it is spent here in the UK. And actually, I was at a meeting recently and they were saying, so in 2013-14, the UK government gave something like 3.6 billion to 18 of the low-income countries. Last year, it was 600 million. That decrease is phenomenal. And of course, you know, we would have been spending that money overseas on behalf of the UK government. So we've got that side of the of funding, which has decreased. And then on the other side, we have money from the public. And whilst we're very fortunate at Plan that our child sponsors are very, very loyal, the cost of living really has hit. And, you know, we went from COVID actually, where we were all worried that it would really affect our fundraising. But actually, during COVID, we actually fared well. People were at home, they weren't traveling, they had more money in their pocket, and they were very generous. Since then, the cost of living has happened. People have gone back to work. They're spending money again, and there is less money. And, you know, the inflation has really hit. And of course, it hits us too, because we have to pay our staff. Our costs go up. Our income doesn't go up with inflation. So it's a bit of a squeeze. So we are constantly really looking at how we make our money go further, make it have as much impact as possible, and try to raise as much funds as we can. So if anybody out there has money they don't know what to do with, come talk to me.
You heard it here. Rose, before you run off today, what's that key takeaway that you'd love for the audience to keep in mind after they finish listening to today's episode?
So I think it's actually, I've already touched on it. It's girls' education, young people and girls' education. I mean, I think there's something like one in every six people in the world is a young person. We don't listen enough to what they've got to say. I feel very fortunate at Plan in that we have a youth advisory panel and we have lots of young people that work right at the centre of our organisation that go and talk to policymakers on behalf of us and on behalf of themselves. And the ability of young people to express what they need and what they want is phenomenal. And so giving young people that opportunity to have a voice and to speak to people in power, I think is absolutely critical. And so, you know, that for me, the takeaway is believe in our young people, give them the opportunity, because they have the ability to change the world, and it is their world. It's their world going forward, and they need to have a say in it.
Wonderful. Rose, thank you so much for joining me and joining us back on the Do One Better podcast today. Always a pleasure.
Thank you very much.
Perfect, and that's a wrap. Thanks very much for tuning in. As always, you've been listening to a great chat with Rose Caldwell, Chief Executive Officer of Plan International UK. For information about this conversation and more than 250 other interviews and case studies with remarkable thought leaders in philanthropy, sustainability, and social entrepreneurship, just visit our website at lidji.org. That's lidji.org. Please click that subscribe button and follow us if you're not already doing so. And I look forward to catching up with you this coming Monday.